Today, on You're Watching a Movie with Silas Lindenstein, it's a film club edition where I am joined by comedian Jeff Lott to talk about one of his favorite films, Dead Again.
You're watching a movie with Silas Lindenstein in the theaters, you find this. So go on and press play and rewind this. This speech that is timeless. Love it like it or we lose it, can't find it. And we ain't keen on being reminded about the film if it isn't tough. We spend a lot of time at the cinema. It's just me and my friends, we watch plenty stuff. For movies, yeah, I've been above. Whether big or they small, no, for me don't make a difference, love. You're watching a movie with Silas Lindenstein in the theaters, you find this. So go on and press play and rewind this. This speech that is timeless. Love it like it or we lose it, can't find it. And we ain't keen on being reminded about the film if it didn't hit. No, gotta lose it. Watch movies with my friends, bringing joy, that's the blueprint. So come on and let's do this. Leave pain behind us and relax your mind. Come watch a movie with Silas.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to You're Watching a Movie with Silas Lindenstein. I am your host, Silas Lindenstein. It's Film Club. It is Film Club where I ask friends around the globe, mostly the United States, to talk to me about one of their favorite films. And today's guest was Jeff Lott, this episode's guest. Jeff Lott, comedian in the Seattle, Washington area. And one of his favorite films, Dead Again. Dead Again is a mystery drama from 1991, starring Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson. I believe they were married at the time. And it's you're gonna hear all about the film in this episode. I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it, and I can't remember if I saw it before. I don't know. I get into all this. We did record this a little bit ago before I got, before COVID came to the house. I got sick. I couldn't record messages. I got an injury. So many things, but I'm back. I'm back with Film Club. It's what I love to do. The only thing I like more than watching movies is talking about them. And that's what I do on Film Club. So I'm back at it. Soccer season also has really interfered with all my stuff. So I haven't been able to get out to many movies. I've been doing soccer, too many children playing soccer and needlessly coaching them all. So anyway, I'll be back. More Film Club coming up. So right now I want you to open your heart, open your ear holes, open your heart and open your ear holes and listen to Film Club with Jeff Lott as we talk about Dead Again.
Yeah.
Jeff Lott, welcome to Film Club.
Ah, thanks for having me, Silas. This is great.
And on Film Club, we talk about Film Club, and we talk about movies. And
good.
You know, today you are on because you suggested. You said one of your favorite movies.
Yeah,
is Kenneth Branagh's Dead Again.
Yes.
And okay, before we, this is going to be a spoiler.
Okay.
Filled episode, so I warn people about that. This is their last warning.
Okay. That's good. That frees me up.
Yeah.
Quick summary
of it. It's rated R. Came out in 1991. 1 hour and 47 minutes. The synopsis: A woman who has lost her memory is taken by a Los Angeles orphanage, and a private eye is enlisted to track her down her identity. But he soon finds out that he might have a past life connection to her that endangers their lives. Directed by Kenneth Branagh, written by Scott Frank, stars Kenneth Branagh, Emma Thompson, and Andy Garcia. Kenneth Branagh is one of those humble people that realizes he's the best person for the part. Consistently.
He really is. And that's an interesting
point.
Do you want to start there? We can start right there about the casting of this.
Yeah. But one other cast member that flipped me out because I did not remember. I think I had seen this at some point, but I only saw part of it. My camera keeps tripping out on me.
I don't know.
Is Robin Williams.
Yes.
Was not expecting him.
No.
And I was like, what? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. I think I saw this on HBO. or something. Like it's one of those films that kept running and I'd have to catch it or something. But I didn't remember a lot about it, but I didn't. And I was, so I was trying to figure, I was like, I had to have seen it because I think I'm guessing too many things, but I forgot the ending to it. Flipped out.
Oh, all the way around. Yeah.
Yeah. But
there's a lot of good symbolism in film, but even if you look at the, I think the Robin Williams casting was interesting because I always think it's interesting when you look at a part like Kenneth Branagh's part, and then the part where Campbell Scott's character comes in later, you know, with his little deal where he tries to, you know, mess everything up and get in between them in the alleyway. So I always wonder, like, I saw Campbell Scott and you see Kenneth Branagh, and I always wonder, like, did Campbell Scott read for that role? And they're like, you know what, we have something else that you're really good for. Mm. But then I saw, you know, when Robin Williams comes in, that was a point where when this came out in 91, some people thought, oh, what an interesting, because he doesn't have a lot of dialogue, but he chews up every scene. He absolutely owns that role as the, you know, kind of the disgraced psychologist who's, you know, making his way that he as much as he can. But he's already at that point, he's already done some pretty heavy dramatic roles. He's already done Good Morning Vietnam. He's already done Dead Poets Society. At that point, he's probably filming The Fisher King. So he's really seated in this role as a dramatic actor. But he just nails that role and even has like a couple of dark turns through the dialogue.
Oh, he's a pervert. Yeah,
he's a bit of he's a little bit handsy. He's overstepping some boundaries as a psychologist. And the writing in this was so good, I thought, too, for like his character, these little things that his character, Cozy Carlisle, is doing, just subtle things where you see, like, this is a guy who lives in his own head all the time. So when, you know, you have a guy who comes in like Kenneth Branagh, his detective Mike Church comes in and brings it up. There's always room for comedy in these, you know, kind of nouveau film noir spots.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, Kenneth Branagh at this point, you know, he's 30, he's coming off of directing Henry V. They have this core group of really, really solid Shakespearean actors who are just nailing these parts. This must have been like cotton candy for them. This was just fluff for them to go through. And that's not to say that it's a bad movie. It's a great movie. I love it. And the writing is so good. You know, Scott Frank also wrote a couple of my other favorite ones, like The Wolverine. He wrote Logan. He wrote Get Shorty.
Oh, okay.
Out of Sight. So this guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
He even wrote, he wrote an episode. I want to say he wrote like an episode of a Disney Kids television show. He wrote, he had some really interesting stuff that he put together. So he's definitely a good writer. And even at that point, you know, early in his career, this was 30 something years ago now. What was the one? Malice. He wrote that. Marley and Me. That was the one. So, I mean, that's quite a turn between Dead Again and Marley and Me.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of meat to this movie that they also make this whole storyline very consumable. There's not a part of it where you're like, all right, this is starting to get away from everybody. Can we bring it back?
No, like they're overacting. Hour 47. I guess that's not that.
It's a tight 145.
Yeah.
It covers a lot of ground, but it moves the whole time.
Yeah.
There's nothing in it that makes you go, what was that for? Was that just to be funny?
Like, I try to think of, like, what would I ask the director something about this film? And I do think the Robin Williams thing is the most interesting thing to me, because I still think when you, even though he'd done a bunch of dramatic stuff, I'm like, what makes you think, let me hire wacky Robin Williams? Like, I want to know how that conversation came up. That's fascinating. Probably one.
I wonder if Kenneth Branagh, maybe, I wonder, I'm sure it's out there somewhere. There might be a backstory about how they got Robin Williams to do his role. It could be the fact, I mean, this is shot, he probably shot over a week. You know, he probably shot his stuff in a week somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was shot in just the basic LA area, Pasadena. And
Branagh likes to work with people he likes. Like, he just had his wife and everything, right?
Yeah. He trusts, you know, people he trusts. And that makes it much easier where, you know, it's like, hey, do whatever you want. I don't have to, you know, he doesn't have to direct a lot. He knows somebody's going to show up with what they want and what they are, and not have to put a lot of work in, especially maybe as a young director. He's like, I need some weight in this. Mm-hmm. The guy who plays Frankie is a fantastic actor. And, you know, he was coming off of, he had shot I, Claudius a few years before that, which is, you know, the role he had in that was pretty chunky. I used to work in a video store, so all this stuff
is okay.
Intertwined. And so when you see these dudes come in and act, and you can tell that they're almost underacting. It's like, look, I know that I have a Ferrari as an actor here.
Yeah.
And all I'm going to do is show off. I'm going to show you how I drift it. I'm going to show you how I parallel park this thing at 50 miles an hour. I'm going to show you how to get in and out of traffic. I'm not going to open it up. I don't have to open it up in this film. I need to play it like they played it so well all the way through.
I'm a little surprised how high Andy Garcia's credits are in this.
Yeah.
I mean, a little misleading when he pops up there. And I was like, oh, I forgot. He's in this film, huh? Like, yeah. Well, not really. Like, really, very brief role.
Yeah, he's not, and his role is an interesting one because he's the only character really who is the most consistent. Like there's this through line, intended or not, there's a through line of duality between, you know, dead again first mm-hmm. off, and then even as we look at the graphic behind us where we have, you know, the lineups of you know, Mike and Margaret, and then at the bottom we have Roman and Amanda or Grace or whatever her, you know, name is.
Yeah,
for reals, they find out who she is. But Gray Baker, Andy Garcia's character, is always this guy. Probably the only flip that he has is from being a war correspondent to flipping to be kind of a gossip columnist, or, you know, yeah, the guy who's churning out all the pulp, because it starts with, you know, murder is the first graphic that we see. And then it's just Gray Baker is writing all of this stuff. And then you meet him and he looks the part, the white suit, the black hair that's just slicked back. You know, he's smoking his own hand-rolled cigarettes. A funny thing about if you pay close attention, we are doing some kind of spoiler stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so if you're watching the film, if you're watching the movie, as it's playing and they keep showing all the headlines and everything, the build up to this first big scene mm-hmm. of Roman getting his hair cut and being on death row, the build up is all of the headlines and all of the news articles. So they show, I think they said something like, there's over 30 of these news articles that keep popping up and they're overlaid and they're fading in and out. So the headlines all change and that tells you the story. But if you pause it shot to shot, every article is the exact same verbiage. So they just keep repeating the article. It's like, by Gray Baker, but and the next one is, you know, different headline, but it's the exact same story.
Yeah.
Different headline, exact same story. So I think that, I don't know why they did that. Maybe it's just something like, oh, no one's going to notice. Just get this thing together.
Huh.
As they put it through there. So yeah, it's kind of a just one of those little things I like to.
They weren't expecting everybody to pause their VCR.
Well, when it first came out, like, no one's gonna. I mean, they made this movie $15 million. It grossed 35.
Yeah,
it's a huge chunk, small huge budget
at that time.
Oh,
what
if you adjust it? It's probably, you know,
yeah, a
couple hundred million.
What do you think the message of the film is?
I think it really hinges on karma. I think that's the one part where kind of what comes around goes around. If you're willing to address your own behavior about what you did, the reason I was thinking about that, cause I watched this, since we agreed to, you know, hey, look at this, and you invited me to do that, which thank you, by the way, cause yeah. I this is fantastic. It's when they start talking about karma in the film, you don't really see it, but it's interwoven until they just straight up bring it up.
Yeah.
In the first part where, you know, talking about Cozy Carlisle, the Robin Williams character, he is not, like, he's somewhat apologetic for his behavior.
Yeah.
But he's still rooted in the fact, like, hey, I was a good psychologist. So I slept with a couple of people.
Yeah.
And then the state sends in this broad who traps me. You're like, you did that to yourself.
Yeah.
Like you did. And as you know, I remember being when this movie came out, being like 16 or 17. And that was that's where I first started hearing about karma in more of an adult conversation. How it addresses behavior and figuring out, you know, you figure out which one you are and be that, like when he talks about being a non-smoker or a smoker.
Yeah.
And seeing someone's behavior and addressing your own behavior. So I think the, you know, what comes around goes around is really
He also says in it, when you wrong somebody in this life, they can get revenge in the next.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. And the whole, you know, the switching back and forth, you know, the switching of even, you know, they switch between, you know, present day and the past. Mm-hmm. And a funny thing about the past, they originally shot everything in color. And then they made the decision in post to, hey, what if we switch it to black and white, which yeah. I think that's a great directorial. It's yeah. a great direction to take it. It puts you right there.
I did not know that they did that.
But the problem they had was that since they had shot everything in color, they had to color adjust and go to black and white. And apparently yeah. that really pissed off the photography department, wardrobe department, set dressing, everything else. They're like, well, if we knew we were going to do black and white, we would have put this thing together better.
Yeah, because it doesn't you make a lot of different choices if you're actually doing if you know you're doing black yeah. and white to bring things out and stuff.
But I would definitely say karma, and especially because of, like I had said earlier, like the duality of everything. Like Gray Baker is consistent through the whole film. He's a writer. He's trying to do the best he can for himself. He's never attached to anyone else in this film, in the story. He goes from being a war correspondent where, you know, Margaret asks him like, oh, do you still miss the war? And, yeah. you know, he kind of giggles about like, all right, you know, oh, you're writing gossip now. And, you know, he kind of owns it. He's not super proud of it, but he kind of owns the story that he's writing of his own life. While at the same time, you know, Roman, through this, you know, when we finally see how some of the static between Roman and Margaret is, or kind of, you know, I'm jumping around a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you start to see where, you know, Roman, for as much passion and love and infatuation that he has with Margaret, he's also got his own problems that he's trying to avoid and not bring up and not yeah. address. And then, you know, they show up outside by the fountain. There's the fight, and that spirals off into a bunch of other stuff, and it all gets resolved. But as we, you know, when they think about, you know, we're looking at how this comes around, Cozy Carlisle brings it up, like you had said. And there's the other part of, especially with the hypnotist, you know, Franklin, who turns out to be, you know, Frankie.
Yeah.
How even he hasn't addressed his own behavior from, you know, his early life
mm-hmm.
that we see, and to where he is now. Like, he's all, there's this hustle. He's always got this side hustle to get ahead a little bit.
Now, Were they the same people though, right? They yeah. weren't in past lives. This was,
mm-mm. yeah, Inga. His
they just
mom,
grew up.
Yeah, they just aged. Yeah, they just aged. Story, yeah.
But correct. At the end, we did establish that there was a gender swap between the two, right?
Between the two, yeah.
So
when Mike gets regressed in the hypnosis. And when he finally sees himself in the mirror.
Yeah. He was a woman.
Yeah. yeah. And when you start hearing, because he says throughout the film, when they first have their first romantic encounter in present day, mm-hmm. you know, and she's like, well, you know, this was just like Margaret and Roman. He's like, I'm not Roman. So there's these little hints right. that he's been dropping. Yeah. And then again, it comes up later, but I'm not Roman, but I'm not. And then all of a sudden you see the regression and he's yeah. standing there as Margaret and he, yeah. you know, he freaks him out and he wakes up and it's like, oh, so, you know, I'm not Roman. Oh, that's what, you know, that connects those two points too.
I thought that was a lovely twist on it. I think it was
my 16-year-old brain then. Just went, what? How could you do that?
Did they just watch it? Like recently because of this?
No, my brain. When I was 16,
okay,
exploded when I saw that. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the best movie ever. You fooled me.
I'm curious. I am curious if now, like, I want to take mysteries and stuff like this to, like, my teenage daughter and find out yeah. If she can pick it out.
Yeah,
before. They can see it coming. Like, because so much work is, like, I've talked about, like, her seeing Die Hard. And I thought mm-hmm. it should blow her mind.
Yeah.
And she was like, meh. And then I realized everything she sees now yeah. is like, that started it all.
Yeah.
So like she's seen everything that's I'm blanking on the word for that right now, but it's derivative. Everything is derivative from Die Hard, the action type movies. So this common man being the action star isn't a big deal for her. So
yeah.
And I'm even thinking now, like, I think at the time I was like, oh my God, it's a woman trapped in a man. Yeah. Who's ever heard of such a thing? Like,
this maybe
would even be a big deal for her. Like, oh yeah, sure. That makes sense.
Especially because just after that, that was what inspired Robin Williams to really develop the part for Mrs. Doubtfire.
Really?
No, I have no idea.
Okay. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to sunk me with that a little bit. So what is it about the film that made you go, this is one of my favorites?
The fact that it's not very well known, but when people see it, they're like, oh, that was really good.
Mm.
That was a really good one. It's because there's not a lot to it. Everything, it's so, it's so story driven, and the characters don't overplay their parts. It's the fact too that it seems like every story now, I feel like with the full, come on of the internet and everything about every movie star's life is right there for you to look at and click on. And this was back when, I had never heard of Kenneth Branagh. I had only heard of him from having directed Henry V and knew that he was a Shakespearean actor just by looking at the box in the video mm-hmm. store. Never heard of Emma Thompson other than the fact that she had been in, a couple of those movies. And up until this point, she had done almost nothing except British TV and stage. So we don't know her in America. These are, these are unknown people. So here you have two great actors, just still coming up. And you have all of these other, you got Robin Williams is in there. Wayne Knight is in there. Campbell Scott's in there, and he's made a little bit of a name for himself at that point. But, even he's got this very minor role. So when I had first seen it, I just thought, what a great movie. And then it came out on video, and I took it home. My parents watched it, like, oh my gosh, this is so good. A lot of reminders and touches to, Hitchcock and some Orson Welles shots in there. So looking at, like, you can watch this movie now and it's still a good movie. It's still one I think that translates. There's nothing where you're like, well, that technology doesn't work. I mean, he's got the big brick cell phone.
Yeah.
There's nothing in it that seems like it, you could update this movie and it would still be all right. But the thing I think that makes the movie work so well is the fact that you have, at that point, you had relatively unknown actors as your leads. You have, right there in the early 90s, everything, like you'd said, everything was, okay, what's our next big action film? We've had Terminator, we've had Terminator 2, we've had, Arnold Schwarzenegger is blowing everything up across the world. He's the guy that everyone's chasing. Sylvester Stallone's trying to get in behind that. You start looking at some of the other stuff and you're just like, I need something to kind of boil it down and calm it down for me. And this is just really good drama, really good acting. The other part, like you were talking about earlier with Die Hard, there's nothing over the top. Like, I can sit here and I can watch this. The music is great. I don't feel like I'm skipping between a lot of scenes and trying to figure out, like, how many Avengers are in this scene? Have we already talked to this one? Do we have a Wookiee? And how many Wookiees are going to be in this one? Where does this fit in a timeline? It's just a movie that sits within itself, and it's a great story with great acting. And when you're done, you're done. There's no part where you're like, well, that didn't get resolved, or this was a big plot hole.
Yeah. It's nice. I was thinking the jealousy of the first time you see a movie with an actor.
Yeah.
The first time a good actor, that when they just appear to you in some film and you hadn't heard of it, like, you don't know. You haven't seen them as anything else, so there is no judgment on them. They are that character, and if they play it well, they're just completely that character for you, and they can just suck you in rather than going, I don't know how many minutes I spent going, Robin Williams, really? You're in this.
Hold on.
Let me focus on the story, but like, you're gonna. And so, I'm thinking, like, man, when you first time you saw Emma Thompson was this? That's great. Because I think the first time I saw her was Much Ado About Nothing, which came out like, I think, 3 years after this, or 4 years after.
And it was their normalization of, I mean, for lack of, I know it's kind of a hot word the past few years, but their normalization, and I think when you, of Shakespeare into film for, it's for American audiences. They're really trying. I mean, they're also, you know, for people who, I've always been very challenged by anything that's Shakespearean. I get it, like what they're doing, and when you break it down and translate it, okay. But so the first time that I saw her in this was like, just, you know, she's in it. I'm not being sexist. This is all tacit.
Yeah.
You know, hey, I'm just saying what we do when you see a movie. Very easily watchable. She moves well. She knows how to use her hands. She's somebody who you could tell who has been on stage and can do these long shots that take a while with a lot of dialogue. Mm-hmm. I remember the first season of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel when we watched that. There are a couple of tracks. If anybody, definitely go watch it. But there are these long tracking shots through hallways. They're having conversations that take 2.5 minutes. There's no cut.
Yeah.
It's, you know, her talking over her shoulder, talking to somebody else over here. And you can tell this is a person who's been on stage, who's had to remember dialogue, who's moving easily, and you just get completely consumed by it. Yeah. And I remember watching this movie, even though I'm sitting next to this girl I had a huge crush on. Her and I were very good friends, and we're in the movie theater watching this, and I completely forgot that Wendy was sitting there next to me. I was just like, and we get done with the movie, we both look at each other kind of like that was fantastic. That was really a good movie. And luckily I was with her because she was 17, so she could buy my ticket. I think I was 16 at that point. But yeah, I when you, like you said, it's, there's the jealousy of when, you know, somebody sees a movie for the first time, you're like, oh, you're gonna love it. Like, I really think. Yeah. And I try not to build stuff up too much anymore, because like you said,
funny you said to me, like, just to be clear, we're watching the 1991 one with Kenneth Branagh. Yeah. And I was like, are there a bunch of other Dead Agains?
There are other things that had been titled Dead Again, and they're just, you know, and again, derivative of, you know, The Edge of Tomorrow and these other things, straight to streaming stuff that they made in Romania for $100.
I get fascinated by stories like this because I do have as a non-religious person, I get fascinated with the afterlife and the idea of reincarnation. Like, that there's a big appeal to reincarnation for me. And then a movie like this is like, there could be a downside. I did like that they weren't like royalty.
Yes.
At least they're like, because everybody thinks they were the king of France. I was the king of France.
Yeah. Oh, they were way. Yeah. I love when people, well, you know, they were able to trace my bloodline back to the second cousin of, you know, King Philip. You're like, there were only like 10 of those people. And the rest of us were garbage men. We were either trying to keep babies alive past the age of 15.
Yeah.
Or shoveling bodies into the river.
Yeah. How come nobody remembers that they were like, yeah, I was 6 months old when I died the first three times. Exactly. I didn't make it very far.
Yeah. That whole, what was the, I heard a really good quote, and I can't remember who it was exactly. It's probably, you know, Ricky Gervais or somebody like that. One of the great philosophers. But it was something along the lines of, we adhere to the thought of an afterlife because our egos will not allow us to think of a universe without us in it. Like, oh yeah, there's got to be something. It can't just all turn up. And that's what, and especially in this, because at that point in my life, was very religiously involved. I was going to church a lot. And I didn't find any disconnect or any discord internally with the idea of reincarnation or another trip around, but it did set me thinking more about, well, what if you keep coming back until you learn all the lessons you're supposed to learn, and then you can move on to whatever is next from that. And that's where, you know, I think I brought that up with my parents, and they were probably like, oh, interesting. And just, you know, sloughed it off because, no, you get one shot. And you got to play by the rules. And then if that doesn't work, then sorry.
Yeah.
to the bad place.
Okay, question on the film though, because I'm trying to see if I missed something.
Okay.
Do we ever find out why she was mute?
I think it was just from the trauma.
Of what?
Okay, so she had I think they said, okay, so she had had a fall or slipped and fell or something.
Was that that wasn't the made up guy?
No.
The guy that made her. Oh wait, so she.
So he said that she had taken a like a sleeping pill or a sleeping medication, okay, and taken too much of it.
Oh, because she did go to. They found her apartment. That's right, and driver's license.
She was living pretty good. She's doing all right.
But it wasn't clear that this.
Of why she started
having these, but she whatever that fall did started jogging these memories, right? Because she did start having these past life things, and it wasn't like it wasn't until that moment, right?
Yeah, she had a traumatic some kind of traumatic incident, and let me see if I even wrote it down,
that basically triggered her to start remembering these things.
Yeah, and completely, you know, shut her down for whatever was.
Did the guy cause it? Did the son who was trying to kill her?
No. Okay. No, she was you know, that's no. I don't think that he would have known that she was there. He's him being that antique dealer and him having that hustle where he was interviewing that one woman when they first come upon him, and you know, Teddy Roosevelt's niece or something like that, trying to figure out where all of this fancy furniture ended up from the Oval Office.
Yeah.
And I think and those little moments of humor I thought were really good, because they put those in there. And when you watch it the first time, those hints that Scott Frank put in the movie, like I'm not Roman, you don't until you go back and watch it, then it starts to clue in. But I thought a really good, either a directorial thing or something that was written into the screenplay, and I've never read the screenplay, I'd really like to see how they match it up. But when he's going through his hypnosis the first time, and there's one other thing I want to go back to about, you know, first times. So when he's regressing, Grace, I guess they call her, and Amanda eventually, but when they're regressing Emma Thompson's character the first time, and she brings up, you know, Roman and Margaret Strauss, and he has to catch his breath. First time I watched the movie, I'm like, he's just choking on something. But then you watch the movie again, and then it clues in later who that guy is and why he almost, you know, wets his pants when all of a sudden she brings these characters up.
Do you think he, okay, so he'd become obsessed with it all and was learning about it.
He's hiding his role in all that.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's been able to put that, tuck that away.
Do you think he understood that people come into each other's lives again and again? And so he, like, do you think he was expecting them to show up at some point? Or that he would run into them and he was like trying to know
how? I don't think he was, only because of where he ended up. He and his mom end up in Los Angeles, California from, you know, where are they at that point? Like Austria or, you know, they when they're in the Strausses in the late 40s. I don't think he was. I think he got as far away as he possibly could to think. But even I thought it would be interesting of, and I might have to go back and look at it again just for some notes and really geek out on it. But when he sees them, you know, they look very much like the characters. They look very much like Roman and Margaret. So I wonder if he ever, if there's maybe just something where
he
glances at them and says, interesting. But like, those first times, that's one thing, you know, when we first see Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson. And then I remember watching an interview with them after this movie was made on Entertainment Tonight, watching them, and they have British accents. And I was like, oh my gosh, they fooled me with the accents too. These people are masked. These are the best actors of all time.
Because they do comment how they each look like the people too, right?
Yeah.
Then when they see, they find the pictures and they go, pictures. Oh, we look like them. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I could
have seen, like, it's that obsession. He's, you know, Frankie has all the pictures. He's got the scissors. He's got, you know, we find out that his mom's got the anklet. He's got all of these things that are wrapped up, almost like he's hoarding all of this stuff to keep it out of the limelight. You know, here's the murder. He got away with this thing, and he's got to keep this hidden until they come in and blow it all up.
Yeah.
And but when I, so talking about first time, so I would, you know, seeing them for the first time, who's an actor that the first time you saw them, you were like, holy, where'd this one come from? Like, if you think about, like, I can go first. Like, the first time I saw Ian McShane on Deadwood playing Al Swearengen, I was like, that dude is the Western version of Darth Vader. The way they wrote him, the way he acted it, another Shakespearean guy, he's so heavy. He's so, he just eats up every single scene that he's in that role. Because I had never seen him in anything else. I mean, between the gravelly voice and the black hair and just not taking shit off of anybody who stands in his way is getting killed. And I remember watching that just going, geez, that guy, wherever they found this dude, nailed it.
I'm verifying.
Oh, okay.
Trying to verify when this film was out. Cause like, I think my answer, I want to say it was Denzel Washington.
Yahoo series. Oh, Denzel Washington. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Cause that would have been 1989 film. Yeah. I think that was the first time I had seen him.
What was that, like Devil in a Blue Dress or something? Or?
What? Glory. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Glory. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Glory. The black, the first black regiment, in, or a black regiment in the Civil War. But there's a scene of him, a scene where he's going to get whipped, for having run away from the, which turns out he ran away to go get shoes, to find shoes that fit him.
He wasn't
trying to leave. And they come back and the,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
The punishment for desertion is flogging, which is whipping. Mm. Right. And so then they take his, they rip the shirt off of him to whip him. And you see all these whip scars.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, Cary Elwes is in it, from Princess Bride, and's like, dude, you can't do this.
Yeah.
Matthew Broderick, stop it. So no.
Is that the one where he just stands there crying
and looks at, and the tear going down his eye. And I was like,
oh yeah,
holy shit, this is an actor. Yeah.
This dude is for real.
Some actors can do more with their eyes. They're just their eyes, what's happening there, and then relate so much more than other people do in their entire history of cinema.
Absolutely.
I think that was the first time, and
he did not
disappoint. His career worked out.
Yeah, it's going well,
I think. Yeah. It's probably one of the best things about being the time that we grew up is probably the best time, where you didn't have access to so many movies and actors just at your fingertip to browse through, that you could discover a film and discover actors. I almost feel like my daughter already knows about all the tons of actors. Like, you have to go back to films that just are not, they have to have retired for her not to know about them or to see it and still then convince her it's worth watching.
Yeah. Because for us to get through all of Star Wars up until The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
We were waiting.
We had to wait
30 something years, 40 years to consume all the stories. And now kids can blow it out in a weekend. They can get everything done in one weekend. And there's so much.
They're like, yeah, I can't, I'm not going to do that. Like,
yeah.
At least the piecemeal. Oh, yeah. Now you need to watch 7 seasons of Clone Wars.
You need to get the storyline.
I don't know. Disney's just figuring it out. They're like, oh yeah, I guess people don't want to watch 20 films to watch this one.
Yeah.
Like, huh? Go figure.
If they really want to, okay, but we're just going to have 2 lines in this episode that bring it all together. And that way people will be able, like, you're right. There was a point where there's buildup. So you can you anticipate, okay, here we go. Now I got to watch this. And now I got to watch this one. And then in a couple of years, oh my gosh, I can't wait to see this. Or you get a year off and then you get into the next one. And there is a point where it's just too much. You're like, you know what? Now I know it's there. It's on the shelf. I'll go get it when I want.
Yeah.
As opposed to being so amped. I'm going to stand in line. I'm going to watch Dead Again 2. I cannot wait to see what happens to the kids.
Or a film like Dead Again could have made it in the box office simply because it was against another film that sold out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was only two screens.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, the mashed potato monster movies sold out. So exactly. I guess we'll see Dead Again because there's nothing else to do. Yeah.
There's another Howie Mandel sequel. We don't know what else
to do tonight. We can't look it up. I don't know what's going on. We were at the movies. That was the plan. So yeah. I guess we'll go to that movie now.
We have five theaters of that and Dead Again. Well, we're here. I guess we're going to go.
Don't go to Dead Again.
What was even, I wonder what was, what was going on? Like what got released that same weekend? But
oh, I had started doing that on some films.
That'd be an interesting. And like I said, like this was a nothing budget. This was $15 million. And so they're not paying, you know, Robin Williams at that point, Dead Poet Society. He's got plenty of money in the bank. There's nobody who's like, other than him. And Andy Garcia's got a little heat at that point. But other than him, there's really nobody who's lighting that screen up where you're like, they got that guy. And I think it's interesting to me, like, especially in when they kind of revive a format of a film or a style of a film, like a film noir, to look at, did they bring elements of classic film noir into this, either story points or, for example, when we were watching Dead Again, like I was addicted to that show and that series. And there's for spaghetti westerns and westerns in general, there's usually like one actor who plays kind of the same person in every movie. Or, you know, every other movie, this guy shows up and he's got an eye patch on, or he's got a beard on, or he's missing an arm, but he always plays the exact same character. So they did that in Deadwood with one guy, with Garrett Dillahunt, who shows up as this real jerk. And so I was wondering in this part, in Dead Again, with Roman's role as a composer, if that's something, there's this conversation he's having with like a very wealthy film producer, where they're at the big party, and you know he comes over and asks for, you know, hey, I need a little more money. I'm about to finish this opera, but such and such didn't sell well. And he was saying, he's like, well, I wanted to make a movie. You know, you asked me to put my music in a movie, but it wasn't good enough. And the producer said, no, the movie's not good enough for your music. And I wondered if. So I kind of did some research, and there were some composers who wrote for movies under different names just to make money as they were going through.
Mm.
And this is back in, you know, the 30s and 40s and 50s, where, you know, classical music is not necessarily something where, you know, you're going to call into the radio station and like, I have got to hear Brahms. It's a Saturday afternoon, you know, fire up some of that Wagner. We're ready to party tonight. But at the same time, so they interlace that little part of it. So I think Scott Frank really gets into what he's writing to put little stuff like that in it, but it also really humanizes this character and immediately sets off the next 5 minutes of the movie and, you know, really gets you into that second, like really the meat of the second act, where all of a sudden now we have tension and now we have a lot of problems going on in this relationship that they're not, again, going back to earlier, problems they're not addressing in their own personalities and relationships. They're dancing around the problem as opposed to saying, here's what happened. We need to figure this out. And that's where the karma comes back a little bit.
Okay. I have the box office for you.
Okay.
So the weekend it came out was August 30th, 1991. Dead Again was the number one film that weekend.
Okay.
Followed by Child's Play 3. Then week 9 of Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Okay. So it's petering out.
Then you had Hot Shots, Doc Hollywood, The Doctor, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which I believe I saw that weekend.
Yep. Would be Labor Day weekend.
Yeah. Labor Day weekend. Yeah. What? Wow. City Slickers. Oh no, maybe I saw that. I remember City Slickers. I saw that in the theater. I loved that film. It was like a favorite.
Great movie.
Boys in the Hood was number 11 that weekend.
Wow.
101 Dalmatians had a re-release, almost made as much money. Man, Regarding Henry came out that weekend.
Really? Wow. Wait, okay, so that's another
wait
one.
Wait a second. How is number 21
released that weekend?
Wow. Wait,
that must have not got any press.
No. Sorry, I'm misreading this. It says weeks, huh? I don't know how they are doing.
Because at that point, Harrison Ford is still
made $38 million. So that's not.
He's kind of, at that point. He's like this kind of the thinking man's Tom Cruise.
Well, okay, those are all the ones playing that weekend. I don't know why this thing that I'm looking at says nine. The only one that had as 9 weeks was Terminator 2, but the rest of them had a lot of money total gross. So I don't know what was going on, but that's what it was up against. It was the number one film that week. So
all right. It got some good, buildup to it where you're like, what is going on? And plus, it's possible people had gone to a couple of summer blockbusters at that point and they keep seeing the trailer for that, like, oh, that looks good, hey, instead of going to the lake next weekend, why don't we just stick around and watch this? Everyone's on vacation, that's probably why all the families are out, just lonely people watching Dead Again.
And yeah, me. It's funny, it says it only played in 745 theaters that weekend
and it was number one.
Yeah, but yeah,
$110,000.
It made $6 million.
Opening weekend. Wow. All right.
Yeah. $6.3 million.
Okay.
As long as I have that date right. I think that was the date right. But yeah. Impressive.
Started well. Ended well.
Yeah. I mean, it probably had a short run, and that's a demise. I'm sure Hollywood has figured out how to make it it lost money so that they don't have to pay the actors. But
yeah. Nobody's getting residuals.
Yeah. But yeah, it is interesting to, I think it's fascinating to take see where it fit in into the things that you were watching around then.
Yeah. And I'd seen, you look at those, okay, Child's Play, T2, Hot Shots, Doc Hollywood, Sleety Sleety. I've seen all of those movies.
Yeah.
I probably saw at least three of them that summer.
Silence of the Lambs was still in theaters at this point. Good Lord. Only 130 theaters still, but it was still took in 116,000 that weekend. That's,
oh man,
like enough people like, oh, I guess we got to go watch it still.
Yeah. Some real creepazoids in the back. We got to go see it again. Don't wear the face mask this time.
But interesting, Regarding Henry was the only other Paramount Pictures film out that weekend taking in money.
Movie did really well comparatively to all that other stuff. Definitely not a blockbuster. There's no special effects. There's special effects in it, but within all of this is the theme of, there's scissors throughout this whole movie from the very beginning, where, she's at the orphanage and she wakes up screaming and like, well, she's been screaming this in her sleep, and it's, Die Scher or Deicher, and it's just German for the shears. So that keeps coming up, these parts. So I wondered if the scissors is symbolic for finally cutting something off. But at the end, when we go into her apartment, she walks in, and before they show the whole apartment, she's like, I live here. And you go around and it's just scissors everywhere, and then they've all been decoupled.
Yeah,
so it's just one of each, and they're all pointing in certain ways for, and I think that was an interesting point for her, where, maybe it's just immersion therapy, where she didn't understand while she was, she's obviously doing some kind of sculpture or creation, or, putting all this stuff together for her own decor. And it's just weird. Like if you were a guy and, she's like, hey, why don't we come back to my place?
And, I need scissors.
What's up here?
Well, wait, but okay, it was, why was she so obsessed with scissors?
So if she was, I think just the idea, okay, so
wait, but she wasn't the one stabbed by scissors.
She wasn't the one stabbed, nor did she do the stabbing.
But she fried in the electric chair.
Yes.
For having murdered with scissors. So yes. That's where the obsession was. Okay.
Yeah.
So probably, I think probably sitting in jail, just thinking about who stabbed her.
Yeah.
Who stabbed her. And
probably knowing. Yeah. That's an interesting point too, is that if he had Roman known, and you know, maybe that's why he didn't give up Frankie, because Frankie and his mom had helped him and his previous wife get to safety.
Yeah.
When the Nazis were doing their thing, getting, you know, taking things over. And he was a waif. So maybe he felt a debt of for Frankie and Inga. And it was an interesting, you know, the fact that he had been married before and his wife had died in the trip to freedom in that escape. And that comes up a couple of times. And, you know, Roman at one point he just kind of brings it up and he's kind of somber about it. But it's an interesting, they kind of not even necessarily put a pin in it, but the fact that they revisit it when she says, you know, or the fact that you got all of your money from your ex-wife, why would a, you know, pregnant woman risk this trip? And he is genuinely, how dare you question me about that? Like, yeah. He really is this guarded person of, you know, he's trying to move on through all this stuff, again, not necessarily addressing it, but he's also talking to his first cellist in this symphony. And it's like, who are you to ask me? I mean, we've slept together a couple of times, so come on, this is getting, you know, I'm not ready to have that discussion. So fast forward to the fact that now we have the scissors, but they're not, you know, none of them are put together. It's not just like one pair of scissors. Everything is just everything's been pulled apart and it's all pointing up or down or different ways.
Yeah.
So I really noticed that last night again, because, you know, writing everything down and watching and really watching, okay, what are they doing in the sets? Is there anything in the decoration? Is there anything in the photography that sets it off? And that part of it really was interesting, because I'm thinking, oh, she has scissors in there. But at the end, everything, yes, there are scissors. You put these things together and they can, you know, they're just weapons. Otherwise, they're just points. But when you put them together, now you have a tool. Mm-hmm. That will cut the tie with the past. And I could very easily be overthinking all of that, but it's an interesting choice of, again, I want to go back and look at the screenplay to see if, you know, if that's what he had written in there, or if, you know, just direction and art direction came in. Like, what if we, you know, let's keep the scissors theme. What if we do this to see where that would happen? Yes. Riveting.
Well, no, I'm thinking like, I'm still like, yeah, I think, because it makes more sense though, because that the gender was swapped. Because if you had died from a scissor wound, you know, it would have been so quick.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that couldn't, how he much that really would get in the subconscious.
Yeah. I think that's a traumatic way to go, because yeah. She is trying to fight him. And it's interesting that this movie too is rated R for violence, and because if you watch the TV show Grimm, they cut people's heads off on network TV on Friday nights, and this is a rated R film.
Our society's changed a little bit, right?
Yes, it's a little bit.
Yeah, so I guess that was the only reason.
The violence of it. And I mean, there's maybe two F-bombs in there. I think at that point, if you had two F-bombs, you're getting an R.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it would not probably get an R rating.
PG-13.
Yeah.
Solid PG-13.
Yeah.
And the fact, all right, where was I talking about that? Oh, so the violence of it, it's a brutal way that she's murdered.
Yeah.
And by whom, and the fact that, you know, there's a struggle, and, you know, when he finds her, you know, there's no saving her. So there's that part of, you know, so there's that obsession with the control of the scissors, and the fact that maybe she's broken these things. She's decomposed this, you know, or he has with the swap, he's decomposed this thing to being, in control of it, but not, you know, and the danger is still there, but he will decide, you know, this is no longer a, you know, the tool it was. I'm breaking this thing apart.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that it lingers, I mean, it's everywhere in Amanda's apartment. There is not, it's not like they make a subtle hint or they walk by and they're like, oh, is that a, you know, what an interesting precious moments here with this little kid with this. It's everywhere. It's scary. And even the, you know, the death is a little bit, you know, over the top there at the end. It's, I mean, it's a pretty gory one, but it's very fitting and it kind of brings everything up.
Oh, that and was fact, probably, you know, why it was rated.
Yeah.
That final death.
Yeah.
Did
that could be it.
I wonder at the end, because it puts them together. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, is she really not dating anybody? Is this, do you just go back together? Do you remember all this? And you, wasn't it weird though? Like when he figured out that they were, that they had gender swapped and she was still scared of him.
Yeah.
And she was like, wait, he should be scared of you.
Exactly.
If you, you know, well, I guess she knew that she didn't kill him, but like, wait, you killed me.
Yeah.
But I guess she never got to that part. Did she never see herself?
She never saw herself in a mirror.
So she didn't remember. It seems like I was questioning whether her memories. What did she remember?
Her dreams, I think, were her.
Her dreams were third person.
Yeah, like, exactly. Like,
she's out of body a lot.
Yeah, she's floating through it there. And the fact that she never, like, he never regresses her to the point of looking into the mirror to see out, see who she was, which is smart writing, so it doesn't give anything away.
Yeah.
And then when he gets, I'm trying to think, it was can't believe I just watched it again last night. But when I think, when he regresses Mike, and you know, Mike wakes up and he's again, it's like, I'm not Roman. And it comes to the fact that, like, oh, you were there. So who, you know, who's afraid of who in that? But at the same time, you know, when he goes back to her place and he's having his outburst about, you know, take these scissors, and he's pulling scissors out of the drawer and take these, and he's coming at her, you know, with the points.
Yeah.
He's like, do this here, take my gun and take this part and do it. And then at the end, you know, she says something, he's like, I wouldn't never hurt you, Margaret. And, you know, she loses it and he dives out of film and, you know, out of frame. And it definitely has an issue where the overall story like builds up to all those key points that they have where, you know, you really, and they did a really good job of, you know, building up, boom, here's that part of the act. Boom, here's the next act. Boom, now we've got to put a button on this thing.
Yeah. I don't know how they go, like, I mean, you just go, I don't know. It's an interesting idea. You just go on, well, I was married to this person before. Ended in a murder. Yeah,
stepping forward. And it's an interesting top. Like, she's living in, you know, she's got this great place. I don't know what she's doing during the day. She's making some dough. He's, you know, the struggling detective.
I could see why he would like, you know what? I think we should be together. I think,
I'm going to sublet my place. I could
move in here.
Get away from a neighbor who can't play piano.
Could we get rid of some of the scissors? Because now that I remember how I died, it's a little traumatic.
Yeah, it's weird. I keep snagging my sweater on that one by the door on the way out. It would be an interesting move in to see him. And then, I don't know, immediately I snapped to like this, you know, early 90s sitcom, you know, In Love Again. You know, he comes in. Hey, what's up? Oh, he snags his sweater coming in the door. Honey, I thought we were going to move these. Oh, no, your brother's going to come by and pick him up.
Does he die on scissors at the end of every episode?
Yeah, like he just, it's just a freeze frame. He's like, oh, and they just stop. I don't see why not.
That'd be funny. All right. Hey, our time's about up here.
I got a heart out. So,
yeah. No, but hey, Jeff, thank you so much for introducing me to this film. It's
thanks for inviting me to do this. This is great.
Fascinating. It was, I mean, well, or less helping me remember. Like, it's like if I did see it again, it's like it was in a past life. So yeah. It allowed me to regress back and experience it again for the first time. And
that's a great wrap up because it definitely, you see it and then you go back and you watch it through fresh eyes.
Yeah.
With new experiences between, you know, those, my God, 30 something years since I had seen it. And I watched it and I was like, I forgot about that part. I definitely remember that part. I remember that differently. And then somebody pops up and says something and you're like, oh, that's the bow on the whole movie right there. That whole part. And I think, you know, especially with Emma Thompson seeing her for the first time, I think that was, you know, her character, Amanda, who comes in and she's got to act and she can't say anything. And I think that's where a lot of people probably fell in love with Mute Women.
I'm like, that's a dream.
You send the emails to Marching Ant.
Thank you for joining us for Film Club.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
And
this is great.
And you folks, thank you for watching.
See movies. Go see movies.
Thank you for watching a movie with Silas Lindenstein.
You're watching a movie with Silas Lindenstein in the theaters, you find this. So go on and press play and rewind this. This speech that is timeless. Love it like it, oh, we lose it, can't find it.
Hey, you like that episode and want to hear more Film Clubs? Be sure to subscribe, like, subscribe, all of that. And you'll be notified the moment a new episode drops.
No, for me, don't make a difference. You're watching the movie with Silas Lindenstein in the theaters, you find this. So go on and press play and rewind this. This speech is timeless. Love it like it, oh, we lose it, can't find it. And we ain't keen on being reminded. But the film, if it didn't hit, no, gotta lose it. Watch movies with my friends, bringing joy, that's the blueprint. So come on and let's do this. Leave pain behind us and relax your mind. Come watch a movie with Silas. Yeah. Yeah.